Welcome to the Monitor Daily Podcast. It's Friday, May 1st. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jessica Mendoza, reading for Linda Feldman.
And I'm Peter Greer.
For millennia, the handshake has been a gesture of peaceful intentions, perhaps even a way to ensure the other person isn't carrying a weapon. In modern times, the handshake has usually stood for a simple hello. But it could also carry deep significance. Last weekend was the 75th anniversary of a historic World War II handshake, the moment when Allied, American, and Soviet soldiers met on a bridge over the Elbe River, effectively cutting Germany in two and signaling the Nazis' imminent defeat. Sadly, the global pandemic forced the cancellation of in-person commemorations of the Elbe handshake. But that doesn't mean the United States and Russia can't still work together on matters of existential importance, as retired Brigadier General Peter Zwack wrote in the Hill newspaper. Extending the New START Treaty, the last strategic U.S.-Russia nuclear weapons accord, is Exhibit A. The urgency of this idea was made clear last December at a U.S.-Russia forum that General Zwack and Linda both attended. There were plenty of handshakes at that meeting. Another participant, Robert Mitchler, a top surgeon in New York City doing his part to battle COVID-19, says he now yearns for the days of a handshake. Alas, that simple gesture is likely a thing of the past. But new customs will spring up. It's the expression of goodwill that counts. Now to our five stories. Today, we explore the racial disparities underlying the pandemic, Joe Biden's Me Too uproar, and how a Monitor writer beat COVID-19. Our first story. A former staffer's charge that Mr. Biden sexually assaulted her in the mid-90s seemed to gain some corroboration this week, forcing Democrats to grapple with questions of double standards and what constitutes a fair hearing.
Believe women has been the mantra of the Me Too movement since it launched in 2017. Now, no less a figure than Joe Biden, the Democrats' presumed nominee for president, has been ensnared. Weeks after a former Senate aide, Tara Reid, alleged that he had sexually assaulted her 27 years ago, and after repeated denials from his campaign, the former vice president has finally addressed the charge himself. "I'm saying unequivocally, it never, never happened," Mr. Biden said Friday on MSNBC's Morning Joe. The controversy has roiled a presidential campaign fully dominated until now by the global pandemic. It has also muddled Mr. Biden's carefully honed image as a champion of women, as he tries to unseat a president facing at least 17 accusations of sexual misconduct. The anguish today among feminists old and young is palpable. "I subscribe to the women must be believed perspective, unless proven otherwise," says Letty Cotton Pogrebin, a founding editor of Ms. Magazine. "At the same time, Joe Biden is our candidate. I'm desperate for him to win," Ms. Pogrebin adds, noting that she never excused President Bill Clinton's behavior. "The alternative is too terrible." This story was reported by Linda Feldman in Washington for The Monitor.
The coronavirus has hit Black communities disproportionately hard. Understanding why can help improve healthcare for minorities going forward.
Mayor Van Johnson made a lot of unpopular decisions in aggressively shutting down Savannah, Georgia, to blunt the spread of coronavirus. And he's not about to apologize. Savannah is 54% Black, and he's seen too much evidence, recently and over the years, that Black health outcomes in America are worse than for other groups. COVID-19 exploited what we already knew. If you were poor, if you were darker, if you were less educated, if you did not have a home, you were going to be disproportionately affected by this, he says. Figures in Georgia and beyond show these trends playing out. Black leaders note, anecdotally, that some community members didn't take the virus seriously early on. But the problems now center around a lack of access to healthcare and historic distrust of the system. Now, Mr. Johnson's approach is starting to win converts in Savannah. And more broadly, the need is for treatment that goes beyond medical care to building relationships, says Lisa Price Stevens, chief medical officer of a Virginia facility. Those relationships do everything when you talk about health. This story was reported by Harry Bruinius in New York and Patrick Johnson in Savannah, Georgia, for The Monitor.
Amid lockdowns, which services are considered crucial? Depending on where you are, the answers range from supermarkets to golf. But some open stores share a common sentiment: pride in providing for their neighbors.
Golf courses, bike shops, pro wrestling, cheese stores, they may not appear to have much in common. But as lockdowns continue amid COVID-19, each has been deemed an essential business somewhere in the world. There's a clear consensus that banks, grocery stores, gas stations, and the like qualify as essential. But other decisions about which services should stay open reveal the character of country and culture, as leaders make hard choices about what's critical to a functioning society. For owners, operating amid social distancing protocols has brought extra challenges. But some also say there's been an unexpected joy in being able to serve their community. I am not a nurse or on the front line, but I'm still here to provide some happiness to people, says Bernard Mureveau, owner of the cheese shop Fromagerie Les Alpages in the French city of Grenoble. It's much more intimate because service takes longer. It's as if we are returning to traditional commerce, commerce of the past, says Mr. Mureveau. He's been seeing a lot of children in the shop, people he's known since they toddled in with their parents decades ago. Now, they shop for their parents and grandparents, who are distancing at home. This story was reported by Lenora Chu in Berlin for The Monitor.
Brave healthcare workers, strong family bonds, a flood of support and prayer from friends around the world. Our correspondent shares how all helped him heal.
As far as Peter Ford was concerned, once he had finished at the clinic, he was going back home. Instead, the clinic sent him straight to hospital. And so began his personal fight with the coronavirus. In France, where he lives, the overwhelming majority of even the worst affected patients have lived to tell the tale. But as his wife, Edith, blew a goodbye kiss from the entrance to the hospital, he felt extremely vulnerable. The staff who helped Peter had volunteered to serve on the coronavirus ward. Their courage was intensely moving. But one night, doctors told him he would be moved in the morning to the intensive care unit. "No," he said, "because there are fewer ways out of there." Left with his thoughts, Peter marshaled them into the protective wall he had been constructing in his head. It grew image by image, friends, his son, their family cat hiding in the rose bushes. At its heart stood Edith, her love for him and his for her. Cementing the structure were the thoughts, messages, and prayers from friends. Believers of every ecumenical stripe prayed for him. Non-believers sent love and concern too. He felt that in his body and his soul. He wove it all into a cord he could cling to. He was no longer alone. You can find the full first-person account by Peter Ford in today's issue.
When looking for films to transport you during lockdown, start with those by Indian auteur Satyajit Rai. No other director has so consistently expressed what it means to be alive, says our film critic Peter Rayner. No other filmmaker, male or female, has explored with such profound grace and understanding the inner lives of women. Check out today's issue for his recommendations. Now, commentary on creativity during the COVID-19 pandemic from The Monitor's editorial board. Right now, around the world, one of the largest creative exercises is taking place. Thousands of political leaders are deciding when to reopen their economies. They must challenge old ways of thinking and invent new approaches. But they are not alone. In their isolation at home, families are learning to solve problems posed by the pandemic. With classrooms closed, schools are testing their assumptions about how students learn. Retailers are trying new ways to keep customers. The coronavirus may have weakened much of society, but the Great Weakening has stirred a great awakening. People are digging deeper for inspiration and breaking mental chains. Trends like digitization and online learning have been fast-forwarded. Even in the midst of the crisis, it is time to celebrate the shift toward creativity and unity. One example is the Call to Unite, a 24-hour global streamathon that starts today at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. The event's goal? To help you turn the pain of this moment into possibility for tomorrow and inspire you to pay it forward. Parts of life may eventually return to the prior normal. The ability to envision a new life may not. That's a wrap for the news. You can find the full-length versions of these stories in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. Thank you for joining us. Please come back Monday when we look at the building campaign to make China pay reparations for the novel coronavirus outbreak. In these uncertain times, fear can sometimes overshadow our hope, joy, and peace. But today's Christian Science spiritual perspective contributor experienced how divine love comforts like nothing else. You can find her story in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. We want to give a quick thanks to our staff, including today's audio production team, Jingnan Peng and Jeff Turton. This podcast.